So tonight is the second instalment in Keheles, and the first recording is Baruch Hashem available on Start Your Day the Torah Way and on the Gem site. So if you haven't caught up with that, I really suggest you listen to that. We did no psukim in that first one. It was an intro to what Keheles is and the difficulty in learning Keheles, which is really, really important to have as a background. And tonight, I'd like to just tuck in on Aleph Aleph, on chapter 1, verse 1. If you have a pencil, or you're making notes in a sefer, or on your own personal notes, I'd like you to draw up a little bit of a chart for the first two psukim. We're straight the way in on a Keheles, which is in English Ecclesiastes, which someone told me means anything to do with the church. So I really don't like the word Ecclesiastes. It's ecclesiastical. It's not Ecclesiastes. It's Keheles, which is a personal name of Solomon, as we learned last time. That was one of his names. And if you have a look on Aleph Aleph 1:1, which we're going to start, please God, right now, it says Divrei Keheles. These are the words. That's like saying, I don't know, Peter. It was his personal name. These are the words of Peter. These are Jeff's words. These are, you know, Barry's words. This is Keheles' words. Keheles being one who gathers in a kehillah. A kahal is a community, and he got everyone together in a kehillah, and he used to preach to them. Hence the term Keheles. He's that guy that gets people together in a kehillah and preaches at them. So they called him preacher man, or kind of thing, basically. And Keheles means kind of like preaching to the community. The one who preaches to the community. So the words of the community. Put like a dotted line to separate over those words, Divrei Keheles, as if they're one term, and write in the number one. That's term one. Ben David. Next words. He's the son of David. He's a Davidson. It's Keheles Davidson. His name is Keheles Davidson. He is the son of King David. He's addressing you now as the son of the king. Put that in like dotted lines. Put in a number two. All right. Melech Yerushalayim. Irrelevant to the fact that his dad happens to be King David, and his dad had lots of sons. In fact, one of his sons, Kil'av, was one of the four mentioned that was so righteous that they didn't die because of any sin that was left on their account. And that was Kil'av, and he didn't become king. Okay? He did not become king. Yet it was Shlomo who became king. But he's saying, I made it. I made it, says Shlomo. I became the king in Jerusalem. Could you write in a little... Could you write in a little number three and put that in brackets as well? Okay, so we've got one is Divrei Keheles, two is Ben David, and three is Melech Yerushalayim. Now, go to the second pasuk. We're going to have to do this as a team, one and two, okay? Where it says, Havel Havolim, futility of futilities, could you put that in brackets or like in like a dotted line? And that's number one. That's going to link with Divrei Keheles. Then the words, Amai Keheles Havel Havolim, Sid Keheles, futility of futilities. Could you write that in as a number two? And then, where it says Hakoyel Havel, everything is futile. Could you write that in as a number three? So Divrei Keheles links to Havel Havolim. Ben David links to Amar Keheles Havel Havolim, and Melech Yerushalayim links to Hakol Havel. And we're going to break that up. Now, I didn't bring my bell. For those that know me, I have a bell. Bing, I'm hitting the bell, I'm going off. We've got to talk about something, otherwise it's going to make no sense. So I've got to give you a Medrash Rabbah. I have to. Because nothing in Keheles is as it seems. If you read the words and you think, oh, that must be talking about this, you've got it wrong. Nothing is as it seems through the whole Megillah. It's not talking about what you think it's talking about. Let's just get some background history in place. Oh, so much to talk about. Please, God bless. It's going to go really, really well. Listen to me. Listen to me really carefully. Listen to me like you're listening to something that's actually important. King David asked God, please, can I build a base Mikdash? And God said, no, because you've got blood on your hands. But one that comes forth from you will build it for me. But he said, but can I at least build the foundations? And God said, yeah, that much you can do. Here's how 99% of the world misinterprets that because they've not learnt them a fortune. Okay? You're probably getting the wrong end of the stick here. Most people think that the reason God didn't like it was because war is bad and a man of bloodshed, it's not the one to build my temple. Just the opposite. The reason God didn't want David to build the base of Migdash was because he's too good. Because he killed people, which is fantastic. You can't do better than that. It's the best you can do. Killing people, fantastic. That's why I don't want you to build it. This is the Medrash, and you've got to see the Akedah Yitzhak on this. The Akedah Yitzhak, Rav Yitzhak Arama. He says like this. There's two types of peace in the world. There's peace which you gain aggressively, and there's peace which you gain passively. Passive peace is generally translated as a lack of strife. As we learned from the Tefillah Shir on the Bracha of Shalom, nothing could be further than the truth. That's not what peace means. From the Torah perspective, the word Shalom means calibration. It does not mean a lack of strife. Indeed, you might have calibration with strife. But a lack of strife without calibration, there's no Shalom. Shalom means alignment with the will of the Creator. Shalemus, completeness. It does not mean a state of lack of war. That's not what it means at all. Indeed, God created you with a Yetzer Hara where you're always at war. And that's your Shalemus. Body and soul together are in a stress against each other where the body is the Yetzer Hara and the Neshama is the Yetzer HaTov. The Neshama wants you not to eat that thing and the body says, oh, but it looks like sizzling bacon and it's awesome. That state of strife is peace. Because that's what God wants from you. That's fantastic. Now, when David wanted to go get peace, if there's anyone in his way, he killed them. Which is fantastic. So much so, says God to David in the Medrash, if you build the base of Migdash, because your peace is the most superior form of peace, which was fought by war to gain alignment with me, you only killed at my say-so, the base of Migdash you build will be too strong and I won't be able to destroy it. And I'm telling you, says God to David, that I've foreseen that my children will rebel against me. And instead of killing them, I'll take out my anger on the sticks and the stones of the base of Migdash and save them. Which means if you, very much like Moses, not being allowed in to the land of Israel for the same reason, if you build the temple, you are so holy and you are so elevated and you have gained a peace which is so bloodstained that nothing will stand in the way of it. It's fantastic. I love it. Problem is, I need that place to be destroyed. What did God say? Now listen to the words very carefully. One that comes forth from you will build it. Says, I can't say these words. I can't say these words. But by Yitzhak Arama, the Balakeda, the Akedah Yitzhak, who was a Rishon, an early commentator who wrote his commentary before 1515 CE, he said, this is what he said, Solomon convinced himself, he persuaded himself that God was talking about him when he wasn't. He fancied himself as the builder of the base of Migdash, so he did it, and he used those words from God as leverage in his own argument that he should do it. What did God mean? One that comes forth from you. The reincarnation of David, he'll build it for me. You're not ready yet. You're not cooked. David is number two out of three. The word Adam is Aleph, Dalad, and then Mem. Aleph, Dalad, Mem, which is A-D-M, right? Adam. That stands for Adam, Aleph, David, Dalad, Mashiach, Mem. Adam came back as David, and David's going to come back as the Messiah. Says God to David, you're not ready on this cycle yet. You will be ready on your next cycle to build what you want. It's very good that you're asking for this. But at the moment, you're a warrior. You've got blood on your hands. It's your job to actively fight for me. That's what I want from you in this cycle round. The third cycle round, you could build me a temple. Now, when Solomon built the temple, Solomon's temple was built on the fact that Solomon never went to war. There was no war that he engaged in. He's a man of passive peace, which means that the temple he builds is going to be frangible. fragile, destructible, temporary, disposable. If you really want to build that, says the Balakeda, you can have it. But know that you're building it for me to knock it down. This is not the temple that I want. It's a temple. Very nice. Yeah, but it's not the one I'm after. That's a difficult medrash to understand. Because if you look at the word Bereshis, which people say is in the beginning, look at it very carefully. It's Ber, Rosh, Yud, Sof. At the head for 410 years. The word Bereshis, the first word of the Torah, is Ber, at, Rosh, the head, and the last letters, Yud and Sof, add up 10 plus 4 to 400, it's 410. The first Beis Hamikdash lasted 410 years. The golden period of Judaism might have been Solomon's temple. But the truth is, one generation after Solomon to Rehoboam, thing already went to pot. The building lasted as an edifice of 410 years. But the actual golden time of it was only one door, one generation. But Ber Rosh Yud Sof, I've got news for you, that's in this world. It's going to be wiped out. The second temple wasn't a shadow of the first in holiness. The third temple will be, that make the first temple not a shadow of the first. That one's going to be built by Mashiach, which is David incarnate. Hence the term Mashiach ben David, Messiah, the son of, the reincarnation of David himself. So it was really David ben Adam, and that's going to be Mashiach ben David. That's going to be the triple... You can't walk into Keheles without talking about these ideas. Now that we know that Solomon has convinced himself, I'm going to be the builder of the Beis Hamikdash, we know that you can't build the Beis Hamikdash with iron implements. That's a big problem, because how am I going to cut stone? Hatzlacha Rabba, what am I going to do? So he had to find something called the Shamir worm, which is a worm which exuded an amount of radiation, so much so they were kept in lead bottles, says the Tosefta in Seiter. They used to put worms in like a lead bottle. A cousin of mine became a mason by being inaugurated in an Egyptian Masonic lodge. And he had a belt with lots of tools that they had. And one of them was a little lead bottle. That lead bottle is where you keep your worms. And you take a pair of tweezers, you hold the worm up against the rock, and you draw the worm down against the rock, and it exudes a pulse of radiation, and it splits the rock. Now, problem. The Shamir worm was hidden. The Shamir worm was hidden. I'm just going to turn this off to apologize. The Shamir worm was hidden. And Solomon knew how to find it. How? You look in the Mishnah on Pirkei Avos. It says 10 things were created Erev Shabbos. The rainbow, the mouth of the well, the script, the luchos, the staff, and demons, and the Shamir worm. Anything that was made Erev Shabbos is connected to each other. So he knew if he could get in touch with the demons, they would know where the Shamir worm was. So what did he do? Long story, but basically he found a demon who was the king of demons. Now his name was Am, and then the word Shaddkai. Without the K. Am Shaddkai. And he bound that demon with a name which binds it. It's like a seal. People who did Derech Hashem section 3, chapters 2 and 3 will know what I'm talking about, the idea of binding angels or demons, etc., with divine names. Again, Keheles, you can't do Keheles without all the background. And anyway, he gets this demon to show him where the Shamir worm is, and he shows him a place where there's a kind of a bird. I don't know if it's a stork or a crane or a heron, but it's one of those birds that look like, I know that Mr. Hood is here, and he really knows about birds. I have an analogy about Bob the Mallard migrating, and he was the one that told me, mallards don't migrate. Since then, I've changed my tune. I have to change my moshel, you see. But I don't know exactly what bird it was. It was a long-beaked bird, and it utilizes the Shamir worm in its beak, and it gets the Shamir worm to cut holes in the rock to make a nest. And fares a symbiotic relationship. It guards, its job is to guard the Shamir worm's whereabouts. It hides them. So the Shamir worm needs the bird to hide it, which has been doing very well, by the way. And the Shamir worm is needed by the bird to make its nests. So they've got a relationship going. So this king of demons told Solomon, I'll tell you what I have to do. You've got to find the bird. Once you find the bird, watch the bird. When it carves its nest, you'll find the Shamir worm. You can go get the Shamir worm. Okay, one thing led to another. He found the Shamir worm, which means now he can go about the building the Beis Hamikdash. because you can't use iron implements. Okay, Bavakasha. So that's what he was doing. So he went and found. Now, this king of the demons played a trick. When Shlomo was off looking for the Shmear worm, he changed his form into that of Solomon himself and pretended to be the king. Pretended to be the king and ruled. And ruled. Now, while he was there, he set himself up in shop and they thought he was really King Solomon. King Solomon came back with the Shmear worm. And he said, I'm King Solomon, let me in. He goes, no, you're not. Pull the other one, the king's sitting on his throne. He goes, what do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean? Like, you're not Napoleon. Napoleon's inside. Okay, look, yeah, okay. You're outside, he's inside. He goes, no, I'm the king. He goes, no, you're not. You're a madman. The king's in the palace, he's ruling, he's been here for ages. I don't know who you are, but you hop it. For 33 years, he roamed the streets of Jerusalem, knocking on people's doors saying, I'm Kahelis. They're like, yeah, right. I'm Napoleon. One day, Solomon went to the gate and said, listen, has the king been doing anything strange or very odd? He says, if he does, ask me, I'll help you out. And indeed, the king did something very, very strange. Very, very strange. I won't go into detail, but the king called for Bathsheba. He called for what would be his mother. He called for to come to his private chamber. So the guards came out and said, king's behaving really weirdly lately. He goes, good. Ask him to see his feet. Now, demons' legs aren't finished. They're like chickens' legs. Because they made Erev Shabbos, and the Kodesh Baruch Hu dropped everything when Shabbos came in, so he didn't finish their legs. Why? To teach you, drop everything, even if you're in a project, Shabbos comes in, you stop everything. Now, the king had been very careful to hide his legs and his feet for many, many years. Nobody had seen his feet. So they went into the king and they said, can we just see your feet for a minute? He knew he was rumbled, and he flew off. And they let King Solomon back in. Which means what? There were three periods of Solomon's life. One was as a king when he ruled. Two was when he was a vagrant, saying that he was a king, and everyone thought he wasn't anybody. And then three is when he got his throne back. And each of those statuses of his mental existence, which was different, he preached differently. He was a different man. There was the king because he was the king. He's, you know, that's it. He was inaugurated from very young. Then he went out looking to build the base of Middash. Then he got rumbled by this demon. And then he managed to get his throne back. And when he got his throne back, he was a different kind of man. He'd been through a lot of experiences. Now, parenthetically, the Ari HaKadosh said to his Talmud, Rav Moshe Cordovero, said as follows, it said like this. He said, be very, very careful. The wisest man that ever lived was Solomon. He got involved with demons and he got tricked. And he is not an easy spot to trick. How much more so anyone less wise than him? As such, he cautioned very, very strongly for all generations that are Arizal, never get involved with Shindalids. Don't have anything to do with them. You are guaranteed to come a cropper. It's really a mug's game. If Solomon got carboshed by them, you haven't got a chance. And Solomon knew what he was doing. He bound him to start with. Okay, what I have to tell you all this preamble, David going to be Mashiach from Adam, and then the building of the house so that Solomon convinced himself, then he found the Shamir worm, all that so we can just understand there are three phases of Solomon's mentality. We have to get this. Something's very interesting to note here, looking grammatically, is that why does he have to repeat himself in the second verse, where he gives the word Kehelis as a name twice, one in the first verse and one in the second verse, but he doesn't call himself Ben David or Melech Yerushalayim in the second verse. He does say Havel Havolim, Amar Kehelis Havel Havolim, Hakol Havel. So Kehelis is mentioned twice. The name Kehelis comes up twice. And even then, we've still got a very big difficulty with a constant repetition of futility of futilities. And then he says, Hakol Havel at the end. What? Now, it's the Gemara Megillah, Daf Yud Aleph on the base. That's 11b. that says Cahelas went through these three turns of fortune. He was a king, a commoner, and again regained his kingship. That's the Gemara Megillah. And he began his rule as a king, and then later Amshadkai stole his rule as a king, and then he finally, after he relinquished his throne, got it back. That's also Gemara in Gittin as well. You'll see in Gittin, in Samach Ches Amud Beis, that's 68b. And when he was a commoner, he went door to door preaching that he was Cahelas. Now, some of the opinion, Beis Shammai was of the opinion, that he never ruled again. Beis Hillel says that he did. Either he did or he didn't. But, you know, this is a factual historical. He did. You've got to understand what it means. We have to understand it, that when he did rule again, when he got back his throne after he kicked the king of demons out with that ploy, look at his feet, the rule didn't extend over all the countries as previously, which he ruled over a vast empire. He only was king over Jerusalem. So the three phases are number one. One is he's a king over many provinces, like Ahasuerus. People far and wide are coming to hear what he has to say. Then he gets gazumped and he's chucked out by this king of demons. And he's wandering from door to door, literally as a commoner, like a regular bloke, telling everyone he's the king and everyone thinking he's mad. And then finally he gets the kingship back. But when he gets the kingship back, he only has dominion over the city of Jerusalem. Look at the first pasuk. Divrei Cahelas. In stage one of his life, he's Cahelas. He's the one that can group people together and preach. Stage two, he's a Davidson. He's just walking around, being a Ben David. In stage three, he's only Melech B'Yerushalayim. He only has kingship over Jerusalem. Now, without that Gemara in Megillah, and the Gemara in Gittin, and the Medrash Rabbah, on Cahelas, and on Bereishis, and Rabbi Yitzhak Arama, and the Medrash on Shmuel with David, you wouldn't know what's potting in the first pasuk. Welcome to Cahelas. It's like that all the way through. This is what this sefer is like. This is it. You've got to have the background detail, otherwise you don't know what's potting. This is what he's saying here. He's introducing himself to the three stages of his life. You'd never get that if you didn't know that. All that just to set the scene for the first pasuk, right? Now, the name Cahelas was a name that was given to Shlomo before he became a commoner, while he was still on his original throne, the great throne of Solomon, the one everyone thinks about, you know, with all the lions and everything, and that kind of animated throne with all the steps, the one that Ahasuerus really wanted, and he built a copy, and he had it in Shushan, that one. Ah, the great Cahelas. His name was Cahelas at that stage. And he went, and he got kicked off his throne, and then he went from house to house, claiming that he was Cahelas. I was that king that used to preach in public. So that tells us that he was called Cahelas in his first rule, because he used to go around telling people that he was Cahelas. Now, during that period where people would gather to hear his wisdom, already at a relatively young age, that's right at maybe the height of his career was when he was young, actually. He kind of peaked early at the beginning of his rule. It says that royal princes and wise men from the east would flock all the way to Jerusalem just to come and hear what Solomon had to say. He was like the font of wisdom in the world. But he didn't regard himself at that stage as the world being totally futile. He personally saw the world as quite useful. We're going to have to discuss this. He was very highly respected. And after his downfall from the king of demons, and he went round knocking door to door as a commoner, he realized that in reality, everything is vain. He realized in a retrospective that everything he had thought was important in the world when it was his height, actually isn't. And it was during that period where he was knocking door to door as a wannabe king that he arrived at the conclusion that Hakoyel Havel, everything is actually futile. But, importantly, he kept his feelings to himself. He kept his feelings to himself at that stage. Now, the Sefer begins, Divrei Keheles, the words of this man called Keheles, the nickname of the preacher to commoners, or the preacher to kehillas, or communities, or gatherings. When he lost that title, he was only called Ben David. But eventually, when he got back his throne, he's Melech Yushalayim. But he was always of the opinion that all is futile ever since the time that he was called Keheles, but he never made a big deal of it when he was Keheles. So he's looking back on his life, he's telling you, even when I was Keheles, really all is futile, but I didn't quite see it at that stage, I've learned since. Amazing. Very amazing. So we see that these words, Divrei Keheles, is Havel Havolim. Futility, futility, something I was thinking about, but I couldn't say it. Then Amo Keheles, Havel Havolim, says the man called Keheles. I'm Keheles, the one that's been going round, but I've lost my throne. I think everything is futile, but only once I've actually got my throne back can I really say everything really is useless. Now, the question is, one of the things that he's calling useless is humanity. The Ramban and others make this very clear, the Al-Sheikh makes this clear, saying everything's useless, everything's useless, including people. And the question the Mefarshim ask, which is, by the way, as we saw in the Gemara, the Mishnah in Shabbos, that they were thinking of hiding Keheles, that people shouldn't read it. We said that last time. Why? Because it seems to contain potentially heretical ideas or ideas that would confuse the commoner, and therefore maybe it's only best left for the most advanced students, and we'll hide it away as one of the kind of like the apocrypha that you won't be able to learn unless you really know, like, almost like Divrei Kabbalah kind of thing. You know, you can't learn it unless you're qualified. They said, no, at the end of the day, because it concludes with an idea that you've got to serve Hashem, we'll leave it run. But he seems to be saying everything's futile, including you and including me and including everybody. So when he says Hevel Havolim, he really does mean everything's useless, including you and me. The whole concept of creation is utterly futile. That's what he seems to be concluding here. And the question is, obviously, is it? Is it? Then why did God make it? Were you just wasting his time? Chas v'shalom, right? There's obviously got to be something to it. Now, humans are a higher form of creation. They're set apart from others by God himself. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the entire world for Adam HaRishon, for a human, for one human being. So if so, can you really conclude that the whole world and Adam in it is futile? Now, Shlomo knows you're going to ask this question. He gets it. He's so ahead of game plan. With the whole Sefer, you'll see he's answering one question with the next pasuk. So he says, all is vain. Hakoyel hav, everything's useless, was added at the end of the verse. Now man is called kol. Man is called all. Why? Because it's because of man that the whole thing was made. He's the focal point. I only made the sun and the moon, as the Torah goes on to state in Genesis, so you could organize Yontif, get a calendar together and know when to serve me. So the planets, the stars, gravity, Planck's constant, everything is all there so that humanity can live, exist and do mitzvahs. So he's Kol. And he says at the end, oh, Hakol Havel. Oh, Hakol Havel. Even man, useless. There's a Tikkun Izar I've got to give you. There's also a Medrash on Eov. I've got all the souls which were destined to populate earth originated in Adam HaRishon. There's such an idea in the Torah. Different people were different parts of his body. Certain people were his shoulder blades, his nostrils. We know that. We have a tradition that certain great individuals came from certain body parts of Adam HaRishon. They were associated with that physical organ. And the Medrash Rabbah quotes from Iyov, Lamed Ches Dalet, that's 38:4. And he was asked at the end, Iyov, Job railed against God. He said, "You have punished me unfairly. You're giving me too hard a ride of things. I didn't sin enough to deserve this. You're being so hard because there's been a miscarriage of justice. You have somehow failed in seeing that I'm a better guy than I am, and you're hurting me too much." And Kosh Baruch Hu says, in a whole conversation, Kosh Baruch Hu gives him a dialogue, really, a diatribe, rather. He says, "Yeah, really? I've made a mistake, really?" And he says, "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth?" Now, obviously, God wasn't asking him where he was at the time of creation, because obviously, you know, there was no one there. What he was implying, says the Medrash Rabbah, and the Medrash Bereishis Rabbah on Yud Dalet Tes 14:9, says that all souls existed with the creation of the world. If Job had known the origin of his soul, he would have been in a position to understand the judgment that had been passed on him. He would have got it. He said, "Where were you when I created the foundation of the earth, which is all humanity? Humanity is the foundation, because that's what I'm doing this whole project for. You, had you have known what your place was, you'd realize exactly why you got to be there. Every single thing I've created has a purpose. Everything, the most superfluous insect, has a purpose. You have a purpose. You and there, you don't know how it works." Now, the implication is that all souls originated from Adam, who was the first human on earth of that kind, of that species. And all souls were in existence at that time, existing in him. And when he sinned, he was shattered or split into fragments, hence individuals being separate from him. So Adam is called Kol. He's called all. And Solomon is saying, HaKol Havel, the all, Adam HaRishon, is useless. It's futile. Even man, who was given the name Kol, who was given the name all by the Medrash, has an existence as futile as that of anything else in creation. A speck of dust, an ant, an antelope, a whale. It doesn't matter. There's no difference. So the verse ends, all is futile. So he's concluding that all of creation was futile, except for certain things which preceded the world. There are certain things which preceded the world. And one of those things which preceded the world was the concept of Torah. If you learn Torah, which is prior to the world, you can justify everything. But the world itself, devoid of that which is prior to it, is useless. If you take spirituality out of the mix, then there's no point to the physicality. The Telzer Rosh Yeshiva, one of my Rebbe's Rebbe's, said that if you take Ruchnias, spirituality, out of creation, the Gentiles have translated the understanding of the world correctly. Everything is a complete mess. Solomon beat them to it. He said, "Yep, indeed it is. If you take the soul and its role to get close to God out of it, there is nothing. There's absolutely nothing in and of itself with intrinsic value. Because everything you've got in this world is temporary. Everything. And the world itself is a temporary sphere. There's nothing of any lasting permanence to it. The only thing which is lasting is what you develop in your relationship to the Borei Olam. That's lasting. Everything else, useless. And humanity that doesn't utilize this ability is also useless. No more useful than anything else." Very interesting idea. Now, right here on the Medrash goes off on a very, very long discourse. The Medrash Rabbah on Keheles. In the first perek, right here, on the first pasuk. And it starts quoting Rav Huna in the name of Rav Acha. And it said there's a pasuk in Tehillim, 144:4, where David says, Adam lehevel domah, man is like a breath. What did he mean by breath, says the Medrash? The Medrash asks on this pasuk in Tehillim while it's commenting on Keheles. It brings the pasuk in Tehillim and it says, what's David talking about? What do you mean man's like a breath? Did he refer, says the Medrash, they start arguing out, is he talking about the steam that comes out of an oven? Because the steam that comes out of an oven, like, which is called hevel, which is like vapor, does have some kind of substance. It does have a substance. So maybe David is saying, man is like a breath, but there is some substance to him which will stand against his son, Solomon, who says he's completely useless. Or, the Medrash says, is it like the vapor which comes off the top of a stove, not out the oven? The vapor that comes out the top of the stove has less substance than that, but it's still got some substance. So Shlomo says, everything's futile. So hevel havolim, futility of futilities, is something with no substance at all. So Shmuel bar Nachman said the name of Rabbi Yeshua ben Korach, and he says, it's like a man who stacks seven pots, one on top of the other. The steam in the top pot is hardly discernible. And man is compared to the steam in the top pot. That's how the Medrash finishes off there. Hardly tangible at all. Essentially, man is worthless, except for the fact that he can attach himself to Torah, which has a genuine, lasting, eternal value. But in and of yourself, the things that you're going after, gold medals or whatever it is you want, in and of themselves, they don't look useless. It's a vanity. It's not necessary. There's a very famous pasuk in Tehillim, Tzadi Yud. That's Psalms 90:10. It says, man's life is 70 years and 10. Right? 70 years. With strength 80. 70 years. So the Medrash says, when people come to this world, because of that pasuk in Tehillim, they think, basically, they got 70 years. You got 70 good years, right? Enjoy them. So David is teaching us that life is actually like a breath, like a passing shadow. It's a shadow. And he says, David HaMelech says, on this Medrash in Tehillim, that it's like the shadow of a bird in flight. What an interesting metaphor, no? The shadow of a bird in flight. So when a bird flies, it casts a shadow on the ground beneath it. And you can see the shadow moving across the ground. What? There's different kinds of shadows. Different kinds of shadows. Says the Medrash on this passing of Tehillim. Says, let's talk about the shadow of a wall. A wall casts a shadow. Now, that kind of shadow protects you from the sun. And if you know what you're doing, it can tell you what time it is. So if you've got a hot day, you can stand in the shadow cast by a wall and you can look on the ground and you can see where the shadow's moving. You can reckon it's about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, that kind of time. It's quite a useful thing. That's the shadow of a wall. And the Medrash says, but what about the shadow of a tree? The shadow, not the shade of a tree, the shadow that's cast by a tree. Now that offers very little protection from the sun, because the sun shines through its branches, and if you stand in the shadow, you'll get hit by the sunlight which creeps in between the branches. Not like a wall, which gives you solid protection. But you can still tell the time of day through the shadow cast by a tree. If you know what you're doing, the shadow moves around. Still figure out it's 2 o'clock. So it's still useful, but it's less useful in its shade ability or protective ability than the shadow cast by a wall. Then, says the Medrash, explaining David HaMelech, there's the shadow of a bird in flight. And that offers no protection from the sun at all, and you can't tell the time by it. Man, in the words of David, is compared to the third type of shadow, the shadow of a bird in flight. Because he doesn't know when his time's up, he can't tell his time, he can't know for sure when he's going to go, and he's going to leave this world. And he can have no protection from troubles or sorrow, the sun shining, because as a bird is flying, you'd have to run under the bird to kind of keep up with the shadow. It's useless. And no man feels comfortable that he can lead a life free from worry. And he doesn't live as if he's in the shadow of a wall or even a tree. He lives as if he's in the shadow of a bird in flight. So I saw from Simcha Zissel Ziv, who says on this point, he says that the shadow of a bird means that just like the shadow is always moving, unlike the shadow of a wall or a tree, which has a level of consistency, so too a man lives from moment to moment. Every pleasure that comes your way is there for that time, and you don't know what pleasure is coming tomorrow. So you just have to experience one thing at a time, and you have no idea really what experiences are coming tomorrow. So it's like the movement of a shadow of a bird. You don't know if it's going to be going over the sea or a land or wherever it is, that shadow is what it's experiencing. There's no static predictability. So it's a very unpleasant kind of shadow to be the life of, because it gives extremely little. So what's David HaMelech talking about shadows and breath for? So explains David HaMelech in the Medrash. People don't know when death's going to happen. It's a gradual process that begins at birth. And you're living like the shadow of a bird in flight. Your life cannot compare to the shadow of a bird at rest, because that would mean to me that you don't have to worry until old age. You're constantly moving and you have no idea where you're going. As if this wasn't grim and grinding enough, along comes Shmuel in the Medrash. Shmuel, and he says, No, I don't agree with David. I don't agree with the Medrash. This is Shmuel in the Medrash, not Shmuel and Avi. This is Shmuel of the Medrash. Different Shmuel, yeah? And he says, I don't agree that man is like a bird's shadow while it's flying. No, it's not a good example. He says, why? He goes, because at least the sun shines through its feathers, but its body is opaque. And if you were standing under the bird for that moment, it would give you a glimpse of relief. Says Shmuel, I'll tell you what the moshel is. I'll tell you what the metaphor is. I'll tell you what the analogy is. He says that really, man is compared to living in the shadow of a swarm of bees. And that shadow offers absolutely no useful shade whatsoever. Even the most healthy people are aging, and there's not a moment of shade in your life. Even if you're super healthy, top health, you're still dying. Your body is still aging. There's not a moment you can escape it. It's like the shadow cast from a swarm of bees. There's not a moment of respite. Shlomo says, the fact that all is futile, apart from the concepts created prior to the world, is because what? Pasuk Gimel? My Yisroin La'odom. What profit does humanity have for working so hard? B'chol amolai, from all of its tircha, you work and toil under the sun. From all the labor that you labor, tachas ha-shomesh, under the sun, you're going to reap no eternal benefit from all that you do under the sun, i.e. in worldly matters, living in the shadow of bees. All that you work for, you're the greatest pole vaulter, made a big business, you got a mortgage, all those things, they're all going to vanish. Think about the mortgages of the people just after the war. Do you remember them? Who won the gold medal in pole vault in the 50s? Who cares? What you're chasing vanishes. If he doesn't toil in Tyre to achieve mitzvahs which are above the sun prior to this world, then you got nothing. Now, Shlomo is rhetorically asking here, what gain do you have from all your toil? What are you getting out of it? Everything's futile. Even man himself, Kol, this Adam person, is futile. The only thing that's going to make Adam endure is if he acts properly. That's all you've really got. You've got to concern yourself with matters pertaining to the world above and not make a major deal out of what's going on in the world below. It's like a prep. You know what it's like? Imagine a hockey team, an ice hockey team, getting ready. What's the biggest cup? Is it the Ryder Cup, the Turner? They've got that cup that looks kind of like a spiral with steps. The best ice hockey cup is a huge trophy, and they all play for it. And they're all in the dressing room putting on their armour and their skates and that colourful top with 86 on with their name on the back and their helmet, and their coach comes in and says, you get out there and you get this, you know, he's running them up. And they all run out onto the ice to play. Imagine if they made a big deal about decorating the changing room. They painted it orange and they put up beautiful furnishings and they put a hi-fi system in. You go, guys, what are you doing? You meant to go out there and you went, no, look at this place, it's gorgeous. There's lockers, there's sinks, there's showers, there's benches. We're going to put cushions on it and put ribbons on it. You'd think they're bonkers. This is not what's important. This is just a preparational room to go out there and win the match. This room is just a portico to get on the get. That's Olam Hazeh. That's this world. It's like a room to get yourself ready. Nothing more. It's not important. Remember, Gan Eden is the Garden of Eden in front of Aden. Adam was meant to get access to Aden, not stick in the garden. Gan Eden was, he was only going to be there for one day, whatever happened. Either he fails and gets banished, or he completes it and gets into Aden. Gan Eden is irrelevant. It's just some place you're hanging about for a day to get yourself ready to get to Aden. It's just a garden, a portico. It's nothing, it's a porch. You've got to work solely for the sake of getting to Aden. Continuing on this subject. Doi heilech v'doi bo. Generations come, says Pasuk Dalet, and generations go. For haaretz l'olam amedes, and the earth abides forever. Oh, wow. Is there what to say on this? This is one of those big pasukim that, you know, there's so much to talk about. I've quoted before to you the Medrash Sacha Tov, which is the Medrash on Tehillim. And it comments on Tehillim 9:7. 9:7. O enemy, the waste places have come to an end forever. It's a pasuk in Tehillim. That in and of itself needs discussion, right? All these, Constantinitis built Constantine, and Romulus built Rome, and Pollius built Pollia, and they all perished. But now all you've got is ruins of each great civilization. Persia, Media, Greece, Egypt, Rome. You find a coin in your garden from these places, it goes in a museum. HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself doesn't suffer the same fate of his creations. It's a very deep idea. It says in Tehillim again, 9, 7 through 8, carrying on what we just read. The cities which you destroyed, their memorial was lost, but Hashem reigns forever. What does that mean? God outlives what he makes, but his creations can never outlast him. You're limited by design. Now, you get these great people, Rome, was it Romulus, whoever built Rome, whoever built Greece, whoever built these places, they come and they go. And Qeheles is talking about the civilizations of mankind which rise up, rule, and turn to dust. In my own generation, my life, I've seen, you know, the fall of the USSR, which is a very great empire, a terrifying empire. It just literally fell to bits. The Mafia took over and basically Russia popped up, right? But it was a great empire, a strong empire, just fell to bits. Literally in what year? Just a few years. A generation comes, a generation goes, and the land which they went to war over and had such strong nationalistic desires. Genghis Khan wanted Mongolia to be the world. He really felt it was a God-given right that he had. He's going to rule the earth. And he loved the land. He loved Mongolia. Whereas now it's been chopped up and taken by China, India, Kazakhstan. Where's it gone? Two others. Rome? What is it? The fifth largest Italian city is London. You know that? The fifth largest Italian city. Such an emigration of Italians to London that London is now the fifth largest Italian city. Isn't that amazing? What's Greece got? Feta cheese and debt. Not much. But in its time, in its power, it was the place. It was Spitz. And they fought for Greece. So Qeheles says, look with your own eyes. For those nations, generations, regimes, which toiled for their land, but were eventually swallowed up by it. They were concerned with business or some kind of time-wasting endeavor. And that'll all cease had they have only spent their time doing Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach, doing something which would give them some kind of link to eternality, they'd still be remaining now in a spiritual realm. And it says, though the heavens shall vanish away like smoke, and the earth shall wax like a garment, they that dwell shall die in the same manner. That's Isaiah 51:6. The souls of the righteous live on eternally, but the souls of those that fight for nationalistic reasons, no, it's all on a clock. It's all on a clock. The country you hold so dear will change. The Celts, the Normans, the Saxons, the Beaker folk, all British at some stage, weren't they? The place was run by Beaker folk at some stage. They really loved the place. Then the Vikings took over. York was Jarvik, right? It was a Viking. They loved it. That was Viking land. Taken over by the Romans, became Italian land. We'll do Pasuk Hay. V'zarach HaShemesh, the sun rises, V'voy HaShemesh, and the sun sets, it goes down, it goes away. And it yearns to the place where it rises. Does the sun yearn anything? Oh, so much. So I'm a Rav Barecha. I've got to show you in the Medrash Rabbah. There's something here. Says here, there's a Medrash Rabbah here. I'm a Rebbe Barecha. Said Rebbe Barecha. Listen to this. We'll do this and then we'll stop, okay? When a potter, this is the Medrash Rabbah on Qeheles, on this pasuk. When a potter lowers vessels into his furnace, what he lowers into it first is the last to come out. Right? Because you're stacking all the pots in, then you push into the back, and the last ones you put in are the first ones you'll take out when you open the kiln. But here, however, with regard to the generations, the ones that went first come first, and the ones that went last come last. He's learning that out from it. What's one thing got to do with another? So the Maharazu comments on the Medrash Rabbah, on this pasuk about the potters. And he says, when there's a potter and he places several things, pots in his kiln, what he puts in first is the farthest from the opening. You've got to push that right to the back of the oven. And therefore you take it out last and vice versa, right? So you would accept that things really are going to be like that for you as well. When Techias HaMesim comes along, when God resurrects the dead, you would think those who passed away first should be the last to come back from the dead, because their bodies have decomposed to the greatest extent, says the Yafet Anaf. They've gone through death longer, therefore they've been more purified, therefore they're going to come back first. And vice versa, those that have just died need longer in the grave before they're resurrected. But where it says here in our pasuk, a generation goes and a generation comes, Solomon is teaching us that the generation that goes, i.e. passes away first, will come back first at the time of Techias HaMesim. It's an interesting idea, no? In fact, those pots you put in the kiln all the way to the back will be the first pots to come out. When God resurrects the dead, he'll do so with the ancients first, not the ones that have just died, which you'll leave in longer. And this now, this whole pasuk, I've got an alert, I've written around this pasuk, big pasuk concept. There's a big idea here to do with the concept of Techias HaMesim, the resurrection of the dead. So you've got to understand, let's just not lose sight of this and we'll stop here. This is Solomon looking back on his whole life, where he's lived a very, very physically imbued, rich, pampered, spoilt lifestyle. He really knows about wealth. And he's seen where it gets you, and he's analysed it. He's gone through everything. This is after Mishlei. This is after How to Use Your Wealth. This is after Shir Shirim, the passion of your youth. This is the whole lot looking back. And he's going, I'm telling you, looking back as an individual, all that really matters is the mitzvahs you've done and coming back to enjoy them. So the first thing that's on his mind, the first thing he's talking about is the uselessness of physicality, the importance of Torah and mitzvahs, and what it's going to get you in the hereafter, which is this world recreated. You've got to come back to this world. I'm not talking about heaven. I'm talking about this world created, where you come back to be revivified, resurrected in this world with a physical body. Because that's all that's going to last. Everything else in the interim, that dressing room for the hockey team, that's going. I'm telling you that's going. So I'd better tell you the wisdom as to what's actually going to happen in a state where it's really going to count. What's going to really count for you is what happens to you in Olam Haba. And to get there, you have to be resurrected. So I'm going to need to tell you about how the system's going to work and what you keep and what you don't keep. But know now that all the physicality you're involved in now is useful only if it plays some part in you getting some kind of benefit in the hereafter. And if it isn't, it is intrinsically worthless, as are you. Even the crown of creation, humanity, Hakayil, everything the creation was made for, Hakol Hovel, the whole thing's useless, unless you utilize it correctly. Now, you need a man like Kehelis to say that, because he lived a life of Gashmias. He says so, and he'll say it in Kehelis. I wanted it, I had it. All the money in the world he had, and he didn't begrudge himself at all with it. He knows really what a pampered lifestyle can lead to. He wasn't a pauper that didn't know what it meant. He had the money and he spent it. Okay, he didn't just invest, you know what I'm saying? He spent the money, you know? He says, I've done this, I know where it leads, I know what it is, I understand the essence of it, it's useless. In and of itself, it's useless. If you're using it for something greater, fantastic. What we need to do next time is unravel Pasuk Hay and Vav, which are kind of like a team. And then Zayin and Ches are the next team. And he goes straight into the concept of reincarnation. First things first, He gets the concept of resurrection, which is the soul rejoining the body in the afterlife. But he also talks about the soul coming down several times on the earth, why that's necessary, and what the soul gains out of it, and what people around such a soul gain from that. He doesn't pull any punches. He doesn't like let you in gently. It's not like a step system. He just sees it all as one and just goes straight to brass tacks. So already he's going to be talking about the spiritual cycle of the soul, what's going to happen in the hereafter, what you get to keep, how physicality affects it, the whole thing. He's straight to business in the first peric. It's quite intense, as we're seeing, right? Be'ez Hashem, we'll go through some of that more next time. I really hope to cut through a good number of pesukim, because once you get into the kind of gist of what he's talking about, the themes are kind of similar. He starts talking about how you can utilize what you get, and then new ideas come up, again, illustrating this, especially the first peric, just illustrates this main theme. So the more we go through it, the more replete your understanding of the first peric will be. Are there any questions that anyone would like to ask on anything we've said so far? Okay, don't worry. If you would like to ask questions but don't feel comfortable, don't worry, you can email or call, and I'm very happy to try to address any questions. In the meantime, I hope you have a wonderful week and a wonderful Shabbos, and please God, I will see you next time.